Okay, hello everyone, can you hear me? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let me remind you of myself first. My name is Sabri Saidam. I'm a Palestinian based in the West Bank. I work in the field of ICT, and contrary to what David had said earlier in the introduction about IDRC, I came to know ICT4D through IDRC. And rest assured that there's not a single Palestinian university that doesn't know the work of IDRC in terms of and in the field of ICT4D. So we owe it to you. We're grateful. I would have to be strict with time, if you allow me, so I don't lose my flight this afternoon. When I came into the room, I said, how can we activate technology so we don't get carried away with discussion? Somebody suggested that we connect our seats to zappers. So once you go beyond the 10 minutes, you will get zapped. I have four distinguished colleagues, and I know their bios is in your file, but I would like to remind you of the personalities. First, starting with my Brazilian friend, Ronaldo. He accepts me as a friend of his. He's the director of the Center for Technology and Society at the School of Law in Rio de Janeiro. He heads the intellectual property law research now for the last 7 years. He's also the director of Creative Common Brazil. He coordinates various inspiring projects in culture and business. Anita, whom I just met, is the champion of IT for change in India. NGO focusing on ICT4D. Her work covers gender, public health, globalization, and information society. She's the voice of Southern countries' perspectives in terms of social justice and equity. Women empowerment and health rights are the most of her prime areas of research and interest. Third is Philia, if I got the name right, who's a retired Tanzanian professor with extensive consultancy experience, mainly focusing on community development and poverty reduction, with focus on gender equity issues. Recently producing Gender Profile of Tanzania in 2006, she's been involved in major studies on gender and poverty reduction, currently leads a four-country study entitled Poverty and ICT in Urban and Rural Eastern Africa, funded by IDRC. So the last, but certainly not the least, is Lawrence Liang, a lawyer and a researcher living in Bangalore. He is known to locally campaign for issues of local concerns. He is the founder of Alternative Law Forum, focusing, I believe, on intellectual property. He is the man behind researching in law, popular culture, and piracy. He's also a loyalist to open source dissemination with a major book titled Guide to Open Content Licenses. So he is on the blacklist of Bill Gates, right?
Actually, I got a job from the offer from him.
So here you go, the first confession today of a traitor sitting around the table. In any case, I just wanted to lighten up and start on a fresher note. I was told the earlier session was only designed to warm up, so I would give my colleagues 10 minutes each, if you allow me. As I said, I will be strict on time, and then we'll take questions. So, off to you, Ronaldo. Okay.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with so many friends and colleagues. Actually, I really liked what Professor Amartya said when he talked about ICT4D. He says that ICTs are important, especially because unpredictable things happen when you use them. And that's exactly what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about what happened in Brazil in the past 3 years regarding these so-called land houses that I wrote about in my short paper. And it's very interesting because efforts to bridge digital exclusion in Brazil have been taking place for a long time, like with different strategies. But then an accident happened. And this accident was the government created a program for people to buy computers with credit lines in which you could pay, for instance, for your computer with $25 per month for, you know, 20 months or something like that. And interestingly, people, rather than buying computers for their own usage, they started like buying these computers to offer internet access or computers for gaming, for people to play against themselves. Everything actually started with the games, and then the internet access came. And very interestingly, this became like small businesses where people would go and pay like $1 for 1 hour of internet access or 50 cents of a dollar. And in 2005, 17% of everybody in Brazil that had access to the internet were accessing internet through these LAN houses. In 2006, 30% were accessing the internet through LAN houses. And in 2007, 49% were accessing the internet through these LAN houses. So it's very interesting to compare, because right now there are 90,000 LAN houses in Brazil. And if you compare that with the number of movie theaters, for instance, there are 2,000 movie theaters. If you compare that with the number of bookstores, there are 2,600 bookstores in Brazil. And the LAN houses are basically in all the cities, all the neighborhoods, especially in the poor neighborhoods. There are LAN houses in the middle of the Amazon. There are even streets in the big cities in which you find one LAN house after the other. And what I really find interesting is that this is an entrepreneurship phenomenon that came from the bottom up. There is a second level of LAN houses going on right now. For instance, people in the favelas, in the slums, they're opening one of their rooms, buying computers, and creating like a LAN house inside of their houses. So it's a LAN house in the house or something like that. And it's interesting because the old LAN house owners are now criticizing this new generation of LAN houses because they say they are too informal and they themselves are pretty much informal. But there is some criticism against this new generation as well. So basically, that's to give you a sense about how digital inclusion changed in the past years. What is important about this LAN house phenomenon is that it's changing the Brazilian public sphere. So basically, next year we are going to have elections, and it will be the first time in which we have a critical mass of people connected to the internet in order to make a difference. So just to give you a sense about what was the reaction in the previous elections that we had from the government regarding the usage of the internet, and it was a very curious reaction because it was a reaction of simply prohibiting the use of the internet for political campaigning. So the previous elections that took place 2 years ago, you could not do campaigning online. That was the reaction. It was forbidden to do that. And after a very long political debate in which we participated, this year the usage of the internet for campaigning was allowed. Not entirely. There are still some restrictions that I found that I still find really bad, but at least they're allowed for next year. And I think that's going to be a very interesting test for this change in the Brazilian political sphere and about the impact of the digital for the Brazilian society. And that's especially important because what happens in Brazil is that we have a divided society in which we have the classes A and B, as we call them, represent only 15% of the Brazilian population. And classes C, D, and E, which are primarily the classes who access the internet through the LAN houses, represent 85% of the Brazilian population. And there is a cultural divide between these two classes. And this is very interesting because basically the entire media landscape in Brazil was all about the classes A and B. And that's why I like so much Lawrence Liang's paper, because the entire culture from classes C, D, and E were considered something like as unofficial sort of culture, even though it was so much more popular than the cultures of classes A and B. So I always like to run an experiment using YouTube to give people a sense of what's going on. It's too bad that my computer is not connected at this screen. But it goes like this. If you search for a very famous Brazilian musician, like, for instance, Tom Jobim, which wrote, like, The Girl from Ipanema on YouTube, and you ask for the video that is most seen at YouTube, it will have something like 1.5 million views. It's okay. It's great. But then if you look for an artist like a band like Aviões do Forró, which is a band completely popular, Class, don't bother if you don't know it, because everybody from classes A and B in Brazil also would not know about them. And if you search for them at YouTube, you will notice that their most viewed video will have like 5 million views. And it was just posted like a short time ago. So this is not an exception. This is actually the rule. If you look for the real popular artists that are making music in the so-called peripheries of Brazil, that are making music that actually speak to the majority of the Brazilian population, their presence online has become really, really impressive. So all the videos from popular artists, they have like 2 million views, 5 million views, 10 million views, while the popular artists that we use to regard them, like Tom Jobim, Caetano Veloso, will have like 1 million views, 800,000 views, or something like that. So this is great because for the first time, there's a chance that the media landscape becomes democratized. It's not only for classes A and B, but everybody has a chance to become visible and to speak. And just to conclude, it's also materializing in the social networks. So, for instance, in Brazil, the most used social networks is Orkut. I think in India it might be the case as well. So Orkut is run by Google, but it's not popular anywhere except for Brazil. And Orkut is fascinating as it is right now because it became a sort of a portrait of the Brazilian society. You have people, not only rich people, but you have like people from all social classes at Orkut. And funny enough, now rich people started to run away from Orkut and go to Facebook. So they said, no, this is becoming too popular. I want to have my exclusive social network with people that are just like me. So people are fleeing to Facebook. And it's very funny because now if you read the traditional media, it's all about how Orkut is bad because Orkut became popularized and how Facebook is great because, you know, you see people that are just like you there. It's very homogeneous. And it's funny because if you look at the numbers, then you have like the answer to all this. Orkut has 50 million people. So you have an entire diversity of people. Like you have people from all sorts of backgrounds there. Not only geeks and like middle class, upper middle class people. And Facebook has 4 million people. Even though this difference, the media still talks about Facebook as being like the greatest thing that ever happened. And everybody now says Orkut is not good for anything because it's become just too popular. There is even a verb that was created in Brazil, which is Orkutização, which is to become like Orkut. So people are now saying, oh, Twitter is becoming Orkutized. So let's stop with Twitter because it's becoming too diverse. Let's keep it only for the geeks and things like that. So this is the landscape. I think I'm optimistic about the situation. I think like this is the beginning of a change. LAN houses will be probably an intermediary stage between these initial steps towards general access. And of course, in the next few years, when people start getting computers at home, probably the LAN house numbers will decrease, but that is just fine because it will be replaced by something else. And let's keep an eye at next year's election because then I think we're really going to see what is the actual impact of ICTs for real democracy. That's it.
Thank you. Exactly 10 minutes. So congrats on keeping the time. Let's move now to Anita.
I'm going to do a little bit of reading and speaking. I think one of the questions that my organization has worked with is it possible to imagine people not necessarily connected to gizmos, but to be, you know, reaping the benefits of the information society? So you don't, if you can imagine the poorest woman, and she's located in a village that we have a field project in, then is it possible to imagine something that can help her address her particular embedded, embodied conditions without necessarily, you know, being linked or being connected? So that's really the context of poverty and human development, which is not to say that, you know, there's tremendous space there for the women that we work with to really be engaged in community computing, in community radio and community video initiatives, which they also do. But I wish, as the forum objectives have urged us, to do two things. One is to take stock of, you know, what's been the technology and development seen in the past 5 years, and also to concentrate on the lessons to be learned in the ICTD domain. And in taking stock, I would first like to revisit what was the theme of the previous Harvard Forum, which is the theme of social enterprise. And that, I think, is of particular relevance to what we have to learn from the field of ICTD. The history of ideas shaping ICTD and its political lineage is a useful point to start from. At the turn of the millennium, the DOTForce, the Digital Opportunity Task Force report of the G8 countries, widely adopted by the funding and aid establishment, spawned a bandwagoning in ICTD practice. Its prescription was for a win-win approach among actors who were divided deeply not just in their aspirations but also in their relative power. And this was in keeping with the flavor of the times, which was a changing political economy of development that required the instrumentalization of well-being. So if you had to say, you know, if you had to argue for women's empowerment, you had to necessarily show why is it good for the economy. The report stated that initiatives planned and managed using a business model are likely to be more sustainable and have a more substantial impact. And this, I think, we will examine through the Indian case. ICTD, that is ICTs and development as a domain, was thus shaped with some congenital predispositions. Its social enterprise model privileged an apolitical path for development. Critical development agenda were to be led by private sector interests, some of the world's richest corporates. So, for instance, the future of governance reform was an e-governance, and the future of e-governance was in engaging the private sector in provision of innovative service delivery. There was a huge epistemological silence in this new brand of development. The literature and knowledge on participatory development and critiques of marketization of development did not seem to matter. The past 5 years have seen some priceless lessons for us on social enterprise and ICTD. In India, many telecenter initiatives avowing allegiance to business models have now folded up. Many have stopped e-governance services that they originally started off with because there are no revenue streams here. While the most marginalized have much to gain in a transformed institutional culture where open information access on livelihoods, entitlements, and rights can directly impact their well-being, the dominant social enterprise model was not geared to this kind of deeper institutional change, nor to a new local techno-social ecology. Although some alternative public finance models, like the one that you were talking about, did show the way for the role of policy in designing a context that could make telecenters and the internet useful to the poor, these models were completely eclipsed by the discursive force and tyranny of the business model approach. And when the poor found no use for the early telecenter models and revenues were not materializing, it was concluded that the poor do not find any relevance for the internet. This was atheoreticism at its classical best. At this juncture, so-called evidence generated by a genre of research in ICTD seemed to show a breakthrough to the future in the so-called successful models that employed a bottom-of-the-pyramid strategy. And one example from the Indian context I would like to talk about is the story of eChopal, which has been much celebrated. As a telecenter social enterprise network, eChopal exemplifies the win-win problematic. With monopolistic control over an entire local agriculture ecology by a transnational corporation that deploys a captive, unregulated ICT network, this idealized prototype of social enterprise and ICTD locks in a large number of farmers into its network, crowding out the small and marginal landholding farmers. And not to forget, bypassing the local middleman who's been adequately demonized in all ICTD literature. From a critical development perspective, the corporate-driven social enterprise ecosystem certainly needs deeper interrogation. Its valorization as an exemplar of the convergence between goals of development and market interests brings back old development questions about trickle-down and Darwinian selection in human development, where the market unworthy can be bypassed. The Eureka moment in ICTD arrived with the rapid diffusion of mobile telephony in the past few years. The literature in this regard studiously avoids any examination of the incumbent mobile telephony architecture, the fact that the mobile phone model is a proprietary network with most applications and services locked in with a network provider. It avoids entanglements with political issues about technology governance, beyond the question of being connected, with a whole question of the terms on which such connection to the network happens. It does not interrogate the fact that network capitalism is embedded within the technological DNA of mobile telephony, which is unlike the internet that was born and grew in public and academic environment, imbibing values of publicness and egalitarianism. The real issues here for human development and poverty are different. Will the poor ever be able to afford internet on mobiles? And if so, what conditions will need to be orchestrated by policy? And even if the poor had access to mobiles, or for that matter, portable gizmos with mobile internet, what regimes of institutional design and technology governance would catalyze their active participation in local governance, connect them to public services, open up new livelihood options, and create the space for forging new solidarities and communities? Beyond voice, which it is obvious is a functionality that everyone needs and wants, who is to provide the applications and services of relevance to the marginalized that the market may have no incentive to make available? How is the individualism characteristic of the mobile society to be transformed creatively for development goals which inherently require the collective or the community to be privileged? Ironically, the failure of the ill-conceived market-led social enterprise model is now being used as evidence to argue the wisdom of pursuing, yet again, a market-led mobile telephony model. The development question is thus not in the realm of social propensities of technologies per se, but about their governance and meanings for equity and social justice. So what are our lessons then? The promise of real emancipation and human development through ICTs can materialize only when ICTs are seen within citizenship frameworks, I mean, similar to the approach that you were talking about. So long as the ICTD potential is not constructed through such an approach, membership in the network society may just be nothing more than owning a gadget or being a beneficiary of projects. I think another very important thing is for us to reimagine inclusion and participation. I think we need to move away from a pure automatism, you know, the fact of, you know, things will happen automatically with diffusion, you know, type of approach. I mean, even in the Brazilian case, one could argue that, you know, in the first place, the favelas needed to have the land houses for things to become unpredictable. So it's a delicate balance. And more importantly, I think we need to completely abandon ethically objectionable theories of bottom of the pyramid. I mean, I dread to think what I would feel to be called as somebody who's on the top of the pyramid. So, I mean, needless to say. And I think we need to focus on less celebrated approaches that have tried to address the political economy of institutions, governance, and local livelihoods, which do exist in India and elsewhere. And here, the dialectic between development discourse and technology politics, that is, between questions of equity and openness, become the significant predictor of membership in the information society, one that social policy must engineer contextually. A major challenge to such a citizenship framework is in the fact that the global community and the present institutional regimes seem to be putting their weight behind the technology user discourse all too heavily and somewhat exclusively. This has meant an overemphasis on privacy, security, individual rights, which are critical, no doubt, but an obscuring of the transformatory context for development and institutional change. And this includes citizen rights vis-a-vis public provisioning, institutional transparency, access to public data systems, community computing, community informatics, etc., which are needed to create an information society of relevance to the poor. Like the proverbial emperor's new clothes, the unabashedness of commercially motivated research in ICTD is well recognized, but the silence around it has seen the worst of atheoretical knowledge that has delegitimized and invisibilized alternatives. What is needed is longer-term research funding for establishing practice theory conversations in the domain. I also think, going back to some of the discussions we had earlier, our theoretical efforts need to focus on the need for new global institutional frameworks. The global ICT governance regime has a huge democratic deficit. There's very little leeway for national governments in this regard in terms of policy choices, as is clear from the debates on IP and on net neutrality.
Can you conclude, please?
Yeah, I'm done. Just 30 seconds. I think in our agreements about what matters most and what seems to be the knowledge gaps, you know, which is something we will discuss during the course of today and tomorrow, it may be worthwhile being more discerning and engaged in our inquiry rather than superficial and rhetorical. I just heard someone at the previous workshop that I was in before coming here say that it's difficult to imagine how Africa would be without mobile phone companies. I think that that's simply not the point. I think a useful parallel here is to look at feminist analysis of microfinance. The questions actually lie elsewhere. The questions are not really about whether microcredit or microfinance are relevant for poor women, but the questions are, how can local development be more accountable to poor women? How can it deliver assured livelihoods, institutions that work, spaces that they have to engage as citizens, to come together, to express their aspirations? There's one more question. What are the current corporate microfinance regimes doing to appropriate the life, labor, and leisure of poor women for capitalist aggrandizement? It's the same with ICTD. You know, the questions are fundamentally more political. It's about the wider socioeconomic institutional context and not pragmatic palliative solutions which will deliver gizmos in the hands of poor women. I also think that I don't wish to, at this point, raise a false binary between ameliorative and transformatory possibilities. I think both go hand in hand, and we need to transcend this dichotomy. I think it all depends on how vividly we are able to dream. And in this context, I would like to say that what I've seen in the debates around ICTD go back to a Tamil saying. Tamil is my mother tongue. And they say that you can wake up a man who's sleeping, but you can't wake up somebody who's pretending to sleep. Thank you.
Thank you. Great. Ophelia, sleep.
Here.
Very nice.
I'm basically going to talk about the research that we are doing and the findings and their implications. Now, we call it PICTURE. It's poverty and ICT in urban and rural areas in Eastern Africa. And the acronym is PICTURE. And we were judged. I mean, the findings show that the use of the ICTs, particularly the mobiles, has grown exponentially. In Tanzania, for example, it has increased by from 1.2% in 2001 to 25% overall. So it has really an increase of nearly 2,000%. And when we asked people what was the biggest change that they had in the last 10 years, they said the ability to communicate quickly, and they meant using the mobile phone. So there's a very positive outlook from the people concerned that about the improvement in communication. And they also, the use of the mobile by the poor as well as by the female, we always think that the females use it less than the male. We found the opposite, in fact, that the females were using it more often than the males. And we also found that those below the poverty line were using it more often than the ones above the poverty line. But one thing we did find is that the poor people still depend on the radio as their most important means of getting information, whereas the more wealthier people, we found that the phone was a more important means of getting information. The popularity of the mobile was shown by the fact that they use all kinds of devices, even in the rural areas where we don't have electricity and you cannot charge the phones and so on. So there's a kind of a sideline of people who invest in things like solar energy or in other means for charging phones. So there is a kind of a new entrepreneurship going on at the same time as the mobile phones are being used. All this is without government intervention. There's been no training for the mobiles, for example, and they use a whole lot of ways of SMS messages and beeping, you know, the call me kind of messages to cut down on the charges. But costs are a big problem. And also the availability. Access, for example, is very uneven between the urban and the rural areas. So the people are embracing the mobile, and it's become very, as I said, it's one of the things that they think is the biggest thing that's happened to them in the last 10 years. But at the same time, the socioeconomic inequality is continuing. The rich get richer and the poorer, in a way, get poorer. So we find that this is a kind of a contradiction. And we find very difficult to talk with policymakers about the role of ICTs in the face of this kind of contradiction. So I hope we have some answers here that, you know, how do we get over this? The other thing is the other contradiction in the developed world, ICTs are an industry, you know, consisting of research, innovation, and competitive marketing. But in the Eastern Africa, we are all receivers. We're kind of passive receivers of the equipment and of the software and the hardware. And some of the information, some of the money that is used for using ICTs, in a way, flows out. And I don't think any research has been done as how much remains. Yes, there is employment, and yes, there is some benefits for some of the people involved in business. But at the same time, a lot of money is going out because the companies that are providing the service have to export some of these funds outside. So there is a kind of an outflow of capital that kind of concerns us. How do we keep this so that we can build up local capacity? And there's no attempt to build up local capacity through a system of partnerships with foreign businesses. I'm talking from the East African experience. At national or even sub-national level. So if you want to get a mobile connectivity into the remotest rural area, you have to wait for the multinationals to do that. And that is not always possible. And the other thing is that there are questions being asked. Is this hard-earned money from the people who are at the bottom of the pyramid? I know she doesn't like this expression. But the people at the poorest level, are they spending much more on communication than they should? And so there we have this contradiction. People want the communication, and yet other people are saying maybe some of this money, which is going out of the country, could have been better used to reduce poverty within the country. So how do we make, the question that we are facing is how do you make the communications, right now it's only used for calling friends and for calling family, and in some cases it's used for transferring money. But at the rural areas, you cannot get the more sophisticated M-Pesa, for example. You only have airtime, which is very small amounts of money. So again, this financial benefit that the people are supposed to get is not evenly spread. It's available in some urban areas and not available in others. So it's at the, you know, what I'm trying to say is that the distribution is extremely unequal. And it's because there is no control, the state does not interfere with this. This is a completely private investment that makes all the decisions as to where this infrastructure should be going. And so we would like to see, I mean, ICTs being used for productive rather than just what I call consumption purposes. And governments and decision makers and development partners, because we use a lot of development aid, in Tanzania and other East African countries, they assume that the technology will do the trick. You get the technology and the technology will reduce poverty, but it's not true. ICTs are not used, integrated in the poverty reduction strategies. We believe that the government has a critical role to play, but at the moment it's not doing that. And it is not even one of the sectors. Unless it's a sector, it doesn't get enough budgeting in the national budgets. So at the moment, ICTs don't get budgeted into any of the subsectors. Research on ICTs so far has focused on access, I think even internationally, on access rather than impact. There are very few studies which are on impact. What has ICTs done to reduce poverty? What has it done to improve education, to improve health? And we think that that is necessary for to convince the state to take a more positive role towards integrating ICTs into their strategies. Meeting the challenges, I think a better integration of ICTs in growth and poverty reduction strategies, an operational strategy for local operators and institutions to use the more extended access to ICTs. In Tanzania, for example, there are plans for a universal access to fund to motivate mobile operators to take the infrastructure to the rural areas so that you have a kind of a hierarchy. You have the national system, and then you have the local operators. It's not yet in force, and there are all kinds of problems about it, but that's one way to do that. I feel that local content is necessary to meet the needs of the people, because people have been asking me, even those who have got mobiles with internet facilities are asking, what do I use this internet for? I mean, what can I get from there? So I think this is a very important question to answer. And more studies on the impact and consequences of ICT on growth and development in their widest sense, to improve the quality of life, to enhance governance and accountability, to create opportunities, and to provide scope for innovation. I have not spoken about the internet because the use of the internet is very low in Tanzania, but I think that's one way. This is something that hopefully in future will develop as people get more used to getting communications through the mobiles.
Thank you. Lawrence?
Professor Amartya Sen, who is not here with us, characterizes Indians as being particularly argumentative people. And I want to table a long-standing argument that I've had with the entire ICT4D sector, particularly in some of the assumptions, the very pedantic and pedagogic assumptions that it has when dealing with the question of the poor. And my brief note is about access beyond developmentalism, technology and the intellectual life of the poor. And I want to speak about this through a particular conversation that we had enabled earlier this year in February 2009 between the well-known French philosopher Jacques Rancière and a group of young kind of, writers, practitioners in an area called Dakshinpuri, which is part of a project run by my colleagues at Sarai called the Cyber Mohalla. Mohalla is a neighborhood. And the Cyber Mohalla projects are about media labs in which young people come and experiment with forms of writing, forms of documenting intellectual life, etc. And this conversation was an interesting one because it wasn't a conversation in which the well-known philosopher comes and gives his knowledge to the world, which you accept, but really one in which the terms of the conversation were set in advance. Rancière's books were translated into Hindi, and the writings of the young practitioners were translated into English and given to each other well in advance, and then they had to have a conversation. Now, the reason I want to look at this is that very often ICT4D has a particular assumption of the subaltern as some kind of an object of digital imagination, particularly in terms of access. There are assumptions, for example, about the real information needs of the poor, a lot of which, for example, deal with the improvement of their materiality and the improvement of their material condition. And the reason we got Rancière to have this conversation with the Cyber Mohalla practitioners is that in his own work, there are interesting ways in which I think we can learn about the assumptions that we make when we think about a field like ICT4D. Rancière was a Marxist labor historian who went to the labor archives to find what he thought would be working class consciousness. So he looked in the 18th century labor archives outside Paris, but what he found surprised him, because what he found were not about workers writing about their condition of work or exploitation or their status as workers. He said that they already knew. No one had to tell them about exploitation. What he found in small journals that they were bringing out were the attempts to write poetry, to write philosophy, and to write literature. In other words, bourgeois aspirations. And Rancière said, you know, this contradiction, he said, how long are we going to live with this contradiction of intellectuals in love with the glorious working day and toil of the worker, and the worker in love with the intellectual nights of the writer? And this perpetual contradiction that we seem to find ourselves in. Because what seemed to be the case in Rancière's account was that when we think of development, we ordinarily think of it as an improvement in material life and the condition of people. But from Rancière's account, it seemed that this was not enough for the workers whose idea of becoming entirely human also meant what it means to claim a stake in a life and thought. So improvement in material conditions obviously are vital. It's hugely important. But how do you also think about it in terms of a distribution of possibilities where you're really talking about various kind of ways in which people can break the divide between those who are condemned to work and those who are entitled to think? In other words, there is a temporal dimension about this, where if temporality is seen as a form of constraint and as a form of possibility of freedom, then really the idea of how do you think about new technologies and the redistribution of temporal opportunities of the nature that we are talking about. Suraj, one of the young writers, a 17-year-old writer at the Cyber Mohalla, in the conversation with Rancière, said, "The capacity of my intellectual life always competes against my imagination. Exploration for me consists of recognizing the continuous pulls by others around me, you know, a constant movement, which propels me to the imagination of intellectual life, which always somehow seems beyond me." I think what this opens out for us is the fact that we all lead intellectual lives, but the material conditions under which we lead our intellectual lives are unequally distributed. When you talk about an intervention like, you know, information technology, how do you see this as a certain redistribution of the possibilities of performing the pleasures of an intellectual life? In other words, how do we move beyond the contradiction of those condemned to work and those who are condemned to think? Another important argument in this entire realm is Rancière's conception of the political is what he would describe as a distribution of the sensible or sensibilities. And we see this, for example, in a lot of ICT4D discourse, silence, giving voice to the invisible, raising visibility, etc. They are really all around certain metaphors of sensibilities. And if you look at ICT and the radical possibilities of ICT, it is a fact that what you also have is an absolute radical redistribution of those who are entitled to participate in the production of sensibilities. Whether it is cheap DVD players, I don't have the time to do this, but our research has really been on how pirate media, for example, and pirate technologies have completely transformed the relationship between producers and distributors of content. There are, of course, critical questions of, you know, what does this mean in terms of the larger concerns that funders, governments, and NGOs have been raising, which is about scalability models, about sustainability, etc. And are these initiatives like the Cyber Mohalla sustainable? At one level, no. Michael Spence, I mean, began with the speculative question of if you had to choose between collapsing infrastructures and cultural memory. In the case that we are talking about, there were three Cyber Mohallas, out of which two have already been destroyed because of the demolition of the slums in which they existed. So we may not be talking about a speculative scenario there. You're talking about a real case scenario where infrastructures are actually destroyed, but there is still a major blog which documented the entire history of that neighborhood. So you can take away our infrastructure, but can you take away our cultural memory? I mean, that for me is not a real kind of a choice. It's a parallel kind of process. So if we start from this assumption that people already know, and how do you work with the possibility of their knowledge? You're also really looking at a kind of a radical rethinking of the idea of equality, because the liberal assumption of equality is how do you move from a position of inequality to a position of equality. But if by definition the criteria of a thinking subject or a thinking being is already equal, the question is, how do you move from equality to equality rather than inequality to equality? I want to conclude with one element which I think is very important for us to retain. Rancière, when he speaks about the entire 18th century, one of the interesting things he talks about is how thinkers like Victor Hugo, you know, great comrades of the working class movement, etc., when they were given poems by workers, Hugo's response to them was that these are more than words. These are the words of a worker. In other words, Rancière describes this as a certain exclusion by homage, right? You don't have to actually engage with the words. They may have been lousy poems. And if anyone else had given him the poems, he would have said that these are lousy poems. But because these are the words of a worker, they're more than just, you know, poems. And I think when thinking about subjectivity and technology, when we think about, for example, the real information needs of the poor as being about only information about the weather or about the price of commodities that they engage in the production of, etc., we tend to run into the danger of, you know, of engaging in a certain exclusion by homage, that there is an assumption that we indeed know what the real information needs of the poor are, and they're not the same information needs as ours. And I think I'd like to end with a quote where Rancière says that the worker was one to whom many lives were owed. I think the poor are also those to whom many lives are owed, where it's not just about creating them as an object of the development and technology discourse, but how do you actually think of them as subjects of technology?
Thank you very much. In fact, extremely rich discussion. I would like to quickly summarize. I've written 6 pages of summary, so I'm sure you'll put up with me. Now, going to Ronaldo, quite interesting, the bottom-up connectivity phenomena you talked about and the cultural divide in connection to technology dissemination, and the social networks as opposed to class difference, and how ICT will be utilized in future elections. I recall before this discussion, before this session, we were talking about the Brazilian president who appeared to be submerged in politics, only to find himself attracted to technology and now seems to be seeding in technology, which is quite interesting. Now, Anita, on the other hand, spoke of the role of ICT4D in societal development, talking about future of government as opposed to e-government, and where innovation of provision of services had become dominant. Also refer to the telecenters models as opposed to business models and the failure of such centers, and touched on a very sensitive issue that we often debate in the developing world, which is the CSR and the reconsideration of the objective of the CSR. Network capitalization embedded in connectivity, in which she used the mobile telephony as an example, also posed the question as who is to provide the underprivileged with ICT services. I think that's a question that often looks for an answer and remains unanswered. Lessons learned, I recall some of the points you mentioned, Anita, the reimagining of inclusion and diffusion, the issue of focusing on less celebrated approaches, and the global institution reconsideration, and maybe further points. Would like to also mention what you have said, the saying, I think it's an Indian saying, that you can make someone who's asleep, you can wake up someone who's asleep, but it's impossible to wake up someone who is pretending to sleep, right? Did I say it right? Okay. Ophelia, on the other hand, was talking about interesting findings, and as she was talking, I felt they apply to my own part of the world as well. Increase in mobile phone ownership, and later on during the course of my intervention at the next session, I will show you how mobile telephony is increasing rapidly as opposed to other technologies. The poor are biggest users of technology. Indeed, is the case in our different parts of the world. Women are also big users of technology, contrary to what's always perceived to be the opposite. Increase in entrepreneurship is clearly evident in rural communities, at least the notion if the means are not there. Social and class division is increasing. The outflow of capital needs of capitalization maybe needs attention. The poverty versus technology also, and Ophelia talked about poverty versus technology and the uses of different uses of technology. The assumption that technology reduces poverty is was, I think, one of the focal points of her discussion. Now, I've sensed that Ophelia was touching on the issue of awareness and the importance to create opportunities, and I liked her discussion or her argument with regards to seeding in innovation. And I often wonder as to how innovation will ever be seeded and what's the real definition of innovation, in, especially in poor communities. Now, concluding with Lawrence, the interesting interjection, ICT4D and the secrets behind the scenes surely needs to be revisited. We all lead intellectual lives, as he said, but the material of such lives is unevenly distributed. Pirated materials and the relation between layers of society with regards to such material infrastructure and cultural memories was discussion on the issue. Need to rethink the idea of inequality and equality. Interesting and strong messages there. This concludes the six-page summary, and would like to open the floor for questions, discussions, and answers. Looks like all are happy. No questions. Anita, I felt I cut you short a bit. There was something else you wanted to say. I'm sorry to have been strict on time, but
nothing particular.
Actually, if I can just say something in passing, it was an absolutely terrific set of four presentations, and what it reminded me of is the power of storytelling in order to get across very complex notions of how different societies organize themselves to people who don't belong to those societies. So I really, really appreciated hearing all of this. And I thought the last presentation was just wonderful on the, in a way, the aspirations of two different stratas of society bypassing each other. And perhaps that leaves us with a question on the ICT4D model.
The lady over there. The lady.
Yeah. I think that some of the points that in my own intervention will hopefully complement or add to Anita's, but I think just to sort of raise some of the, probably against my own arguments, and just get your responses on them. I mean, one was, I'd see, I market had failed to deliver community, how will those be sustainable in the way? Because I just wanted to, but funds, both the funds and the telecenter models in the African context, many of those that have been supply side driven.
This exemplifies the bottom of the pyramid argument. There are people who will be outside of the pyramid anyway. I mean, I would refuse to think they will be further below, because if you did take the bottom of the pyramid approach, then it's possible to argue that the poorest have purchasing power to buy water under privatized regimes, buy health under privatized regimes, buy schooling under privatized regimes, and buy ICTD under privatized regimes, and so on. But that's actually not an argument that will hold, because there will be, for the poor, you know, a trade-off. I mean, you're not going to be able to have purchasing power for everything. So that's my answer about why it's pejorative. The other about market and poverty is that, yes, I was trying to argue that this entire fixation with business models, we've missed the woods for the trees. I think there are many other public finance models in India. There are small things that are happening at sub-district levels, very creative endeavors by local governments, by NGOs, in all of which sustainability is defined very differently. I mean, there has to be, if sustainability is about the entrepreneur making profits, then that is not what the information society is supposed to be. I mean, and in some ways, I think what I was therefore trying to say is that, you know, exclusive market models are not going to work. So, I mean, earlier we were having this discussion about access, and even if the poor are going to be able to buy a mobile phone, what then? What next? I mean, there is an initiative in India, which is by the government of Chhattisgarh, for instance, where India has this system of social provisioning of food grains, you know, which is our basic social protection. So these food grains travel from the warehouses to little villages. Now, in the process, there is a huge amount of corruption, and they tend to disappear. So one of the state governments has, has set up this, transparency by which when the truck leaves the warehouse, then on your mobile, you will be able to track where the truck is stopping and when the food grains actually arrive at the shop from where you are entitled to buy it. And these are the kind of innovations that are really going to, I mean, for whatever material conditions are worthwhile, Lawrence, you know, I think it can make a huge difference for somebody who is hungry to know that they're not losing the food grains they are entitled to. And there are other things where, markets are going to have a role, but it's really the question that went back to the first discussion we had about where is their place, you know. And there are many other examples of institutional transparency being enhanced, along with community activism, you know, which just happens, you know, in that unpredictable way. But for that, you have to set up a dialectic, which I think social policy will have to engineer.
So I just wanted to push more questions on this. The two stories that you told are two very different stories. We've been very different. We've moved from automatic to
yes,
good old pushing the buttons. Okay, sorry. So Ronaldo's telling a story of a classic subsidy to the poor model being converted into a low cost financing for entrepreneurship. And then as the demand increases, you actually see replication of that model in the land houses, in the house model. So that's a model that's very conducive to the model of business model, to the story of business models from the bottom up, entrepreneurship. And the concern there would be that a government instituting a subsidy program like that would say, oh, we didn't mean you to do that. We meant you to stay poor, but with a computer. That's one kind. It was very useful to my mind to hear you focus on what it was about the Ichupal that didn't work, because it suggests essentially three models rather than two, not market and state. You've got the entrepreneurship, in this case through public funding, that was, I don't know, through insight or lack of foresight, ended up being low-cost funding for entrepreneurship. Ichupal, as you're describing it, the problem is that essentially what you get is a vertically integrated business delivering a general-purpose platform combined with a particular downstream service that then ends up controlling that flow. That is to say, the company that uses the Ichupals to overcome the local middlemen and end up controlling. But that still doesn't necessarily, that failure on one hand. On the other hand, you said telecenters failed. Or that particular kind of failure is a very different story that so the question is, in the conversation between the two of you on that, how do you start to learn about what are the appropriate what is the appropriate role? You're pulling against the market rhetoric, which I understand, but then the question is, how do you bring these two to say, okay, let's design a series of models that are distributed, entrepreneurial, self-sustaining, and at the same time not built around the traditional model. So that's in the conversation between the two of you. And the conversation between the two of you, I'd really be curious to hear the question of what role is left for the relationship between being able to get the food you need and being able to think as you will.
In some of our survey work that we did, starting with Lawrence, we found that some of the developmentalists rather unhappy with the results that we were getting, that people were actually, in the six countries that we surveyed, for example, in Sri Lanka, 50% of the respondents at the bottom of the pyramid, socioeconomic groups D and E, say that they don't use the phone for any business, work, or market-related reasons. So, wow, this is terrible. They're not using it for good purposes, right? But one of the big problems that we had with the thinking on this, and again, we had sort of sharpened our question in the second round. In the earlier ones, we were saying, you know, how many calls do you make for this and how many for that? That one is always the relational, keeping in touch with friends and family wins, right? The entertainment stuff wins in volume. But the instrumental is there. Like in Bangladesh, I think we are getting about 70-80% of people saying they use it once a day for some instrumental sort of developmentally correct purpose. So the interesting thing is, these people who question this, who want the poor to be, you know, the, I think there was an old category, right? The worthy poor and the unworthy poor? Something like that. You know, they were not being proper in their behavior. They, if they were to look back at their own behaviors, it would be very interesting to see whether they make more instrumental calls and less relational calls, right? You make one call, and I think the methodological issue here is that one call is not the same as another. You know, when I'm having a heart attack and I'm calling to get the ambulance, that's a call that is worth an enormous amount of money or value to me, while, you know, how are you doing is a sort of a call that I could do without. So I think you raised the question, Lawrence, of, you know, who are we as outsiders? I never have tried to do this, but why is it that there's somebody appointed to decide what people should do with ICTs, right? People do what they want to do with ICTs. Particularly, my argument is, if you are not using public funds, and that's the key argument, if you are not using public funds that have been extracted by force, that's taxation. Or that's money printing, that's inflationary financing, all those things that governments do. If you do not use government money, what is the problem? Why is it that we have to get excited about it? And I think that's an interesting question also to Ophelia's issues. I mean, this is what people do. And they will come up with additional new things to do over time. That's very good. If government money is being used, then I think we have to ask for some forms of accountability. But the interesting thing about the mobile space is that we are not using government money. We are freeing up public funds to be used on water, to be used for primary health care, to be used for primary education. These are the things that we are freeing up that money for. Or we are freeing it up to be used for buying armaments or feeding the politicians, or whatever governments do. We are saying we are taking it out of that limited, I mean, whatever money that we spend in the old days on telecom, couldn't be spent on water. Now we are spending it, we are saying you can do it for water supply. So I think it's an interesting issue that you bring up, what people are doing, and that we shouldn't really be poking about it because we are not using public funds.
I am still trying to recover from the session. It's been pretty strong. And I think that the issues that have been raised are really in line with the complexity of the topic. I think that if there is anything we can say about what we're dealing with is that this is an area of extreme complexity with many layers and many entry points that make the discussion very difficult, because where do you, from what standpoint do you tackle this? But I would like to say that I am most impressed by what Lawrence brought up, precisely because it's very paradoxical. In the sense that we are dealing with poverty, we're talking about overcoming poverty, we're talking about the use of technology to overcome poverty. But at the same time, we're talking about the information economy, the information society, the knowledge economy, the knowledge society, and with unclear definitions as to what these concepts are and what we really have to approach. When Lawrence brought up the issue of the subjective, of the intellectual, I immediately thought about two things that have really made me think a lot about poverty. One of them is a statement that some of the feminists brought up during the 1995 World Summit on Social Development. And they discussed the spiritual dimension of poverty, which was something, you know, like very striking, and it dealt with being able to connect with the subjective and being able to develop aspects that have to do with sensitivity and that have to do with a more of a spiritual dimension. And the second thing that came to mind is a book by Robert Reich that was published at the end of the 80s, in which he talks about the new economy and the types of profiles that citizens need for the new economy. And he talked about the weakening of the power of what he called the routinary worker, the emerging service providers, but very specifically he paid a lot of attention to what he called the symbolic analysts, who are really going to be those who are going to be empowered not only to deal with technologies, but to make money and to have better livelihoods. And symbolic analysts are people who have a capacity to deal with the intellectual, to be creative, to think, to reason, to analyze. These are skills that are intellectual. And I think that the great challenge, and the reason why I find this statement so powerful, is that the real challenge to overcome poverty is not only having access to cell phones or ICTs, but it's having access to what I've been calling the cognitive dimension, to being able to develop your mind so as to be able to understand the information you have access to, because contact with information does not guarantee knowledge or does not guarantee understanding. I think that this is an epistemological fallacy that we've been involved in repeatedly, trying to equate information and knowledge. And the poor need to understand what they get. They need to create knowledge, as Ophelia mentioned. But very specifically, they have to have the skills for the new economy, the skills for the new context. So I think that this is a very powerful statement that really, and I don't want to extend myself, I'll have my chance in the afternoon, but it is a very powerful statement that allows us to think about poverty in the sense of empowering people, providing people with the capacity not only to have the bourgeois luxuries of time and creativity and poetry. Poetry is a symbolic activity, and metaphor is a fundamental aspect of the modern life and what we create. So I think that this allows us to think from the view of the restricted poor, the poor with little knowledge, with little capacity, with the poor who are empowered through intellectual development. And there, the role of education and learning are fundamental. And I think that that's an issue that needs to be paralleled here, you know, the relationship between not only training to use the gadgets, but actually developing the mental and the creative capacities to really be a part of this revolution, which I think is the major possibility of the digital, not only of the information and communication revolution.
Yes. I'd just like to build on Rohan's comments and a discussion in the session about good and bad uses, or development-oriented uses and non-development-oriented uses. And I think, quite honestly, I think that it's a very interesting discussion, and we don't quite know enough, and we need to do more research and understanding, and maybe this is not the right division that we have to make. But I'd just like to comment on at least one of the findings of one of our studies in rural Peru, where we studied the trade, the ferias, which are the rural markets in Peru. And one of the things that we found is that it's very difficult to disentangle social and productive uses of the mobile phone, precisely because all of the, or most of the trade is informal, because all the trade networks are family networks. And even though I know I can get a better price in another market, I'm not going to go there because I don't trust the people there, or, you know, I have to build the confidence and the trust with other people outside my trade network. So asking people, is this a family call, a social call, or a trade call? We find it very hard to disentangle all those in the context of not only, I would say, rural Peru, but in the context of Latin American economies, where 50% of the economy is said to be an informal. And I agree with Rohan. I think the question is less pressing in mobiles because there's no public funds. But what about schools? What about when kids are playing games in publicly funded labs and so on? And I think we also need a lot more evidence there, but I tend to think that ICTs is one of the few examples, or at least one of the very clear examples, of externalities in the consumption, where I, in the act of consumption, I'm building skills which are transferable to many other areas. So I tend to think that we shouldn't think, I don't think there's a productive setup to think of these are good and bad uses. I think we need to, but clearly we need to address this question. I'm saying, well, let's just throw it a question. I think we need to address it in some way, particularly when it involves public funds, but I'm not sure that the framer of good and bad is the most productive one.
The reason why there's concern about social use or consumption use and production use is because eventually I think one does need to get out of the poverty, and poverty is measured in terms of your resources and your capacity to be able to use those resources to overcome the certain income levels. So I still think that there is a way, or there is room to look into the different types of uses. And it is essential for people to be able to make more money, if I can be as crude as that, to be able to pay for their children's school fees, to pay for their health, which they have to pay for now, and to pay for other services, like even getting water. So, I mean, how can we then say that just the social uses, because it's their money, they can use it for whatever they want. What I feel is that if they had some alternatives where this information that they are getting was going to increase their income as well, they would take that alternative. But right now, what is being promoted is just conversations or access to music or access to sports information, etc. And the essential things of improving your income, improving your livelihoods, is missing, because that kind of information is not being disseminated through the mobiles or through the internet. That's where I come from.
Just very quickly, there's so much to say that I don't even know where to start. But I'll be quick. I think there are some key words that have been mentioned. One of them is the informality issue. And that goes back to Professor Benkler's question, which is the success of the land houses only happened because it didn't have to deal directly with the formality issue. So basically what the government did by accident was to provide credit lines for computer sellers directly through the stores. It didn't have to know like who was buying the computer, if it was a company, if it was a business or whatever, what are the usages that were going to take place. It was directly to the stores. So anyone could go there and practice the consumption act of buying the computer and do whatever they want to do with it. If the government had done slightly different, it wouldn't have worked, because then it would have to deal with the issue of formality and informality. And it's very important to mention that out of the 90,000 land houses that there is, possibly 98% of them are informal business. That means that they are not registered as a business or anything like that. And it's actually part of our next project, the project that we are working right now with the RDRC, which is to deal with the issue of informality. So one thing that we are doing right now is how do we change the regulatory environment for the land houses and other cultural businesses that are emerging in order to help them to become more formal. One good example of this is, for instance, the legislation in Brazil compared land houses to gambling places. So you could not have a land house in a distance that was smaller than 2 kilometers, that's approximately 1.3 miles, from a school. So in the city of Rio de Janeiro, there was only two places in which you could have land houses, in the middle of the forest of Tijuca, which is a forest nearby, and in the middle of the Rio-Niterói bridge, which is a 20-kilometer bridge. But now it doesn't work because there is a diving school that just opened in the middle of the bridge, so you can't have a land house there anymore. So basically, we worked with the city of Rio and said, this is crazy. You have to create a different category for land houses, which is not gambling. It's something else. And then the federal government heard what we were saying, and they created a category that is called land house. And then now it's a bit easier to become formal. So these are the types of conflicts that are emerging. And I think the formality issue is very important. Whenever I say this, there's people that say, you're going to formalize that. Why? Because it's working so well. The problem of not being formalized is the problem of instability, because everything can vanish according to the, you know, mores of the moment or everything like that. So there is a value into formalization. Our challenge is how to think formalization without losing the flexibilities that made that project become successful. I think that's the real challenge. It's a very difficult challenge, but that's what we are working at for the next 2 years. Like, we're trying to contribute and how to bridge this challenge.
This concludes our session. The microphone doesn't work.
Well, thank you ever so much for all our speakers. I think this is one of the richest session one has been to. I would like to thank you really for all the hard work. And I would like to thank the audience for the rich questions and rich interventions. I would like to say at the end that this session maybe leaves us with more questions than answers. Mm-hmm. But we're yet hopeful that the food for thought will be basically translated into thoughts that we take with us and produce and follow up in our society. Now, talking of food, I think it's time for real food. So I hope you enjoy lunch. Thank you.